Good evening, and welcome to the Christian Science Monitor News Hour, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading service. I'm Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, your volunteer reader for this hour of international and national news from the Christian Science Monitor. For today, Wednesday, April 23rd, 2025. Now here's our first national item for today. It's entitled, As Cities Fight to Retain Sanctuary Status, Some Immigrants Question the Policy. The Trump administration wants to take away federal funding from sanctuary cities. Two in Massachusetts are suing. As they observe increased immigration enforcement, some immigrants say the policies are not effective. This item was written by Cameron Pugh, a staff writer, and Jacob Posner, a staff writer. Chelsea, Massachusetts, a municipality just outside Boston, calls itself a sanctuary city, meaning it limits cooperation with federal immigration authorities. But now, the Trump administration's moves to deport unauthorized immigrants and some who are in the U.S. legally are raising the question here of whether the city's sanctuary label holds meaning. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has expanded its operations in the city, residents say, spreading fear and suspicion in this working-class community. Seeking to hold on to what they say is essential to their identities, Chelsea and nearby Somerville have sued to prevent the Trump administration from withholding millions in federal funding. Other cities, from San Francisco to New Haven, Connecticut, have filed similar lawsuits. Like other sanctuary cities, Chelsea and Somerville do not prevent ICE operations, but police there do not help ICE with arrests and cannot routinely ask about or investigate immigration status. The cities also hold people suspected of violating immigration laws, only if ordered to do so by a judge, a statewide requirement because of a 2017 court ruling. Yet, distress over ICE's activity is apparent in Chelsea, where 45% of people are foreign-born, and nearly two-thirds are Latino. Trust has fractured in the community, says Laura, who works in Chelsea and asked that her last name not be used because she has overstayed a student visa. People are afraid their neighbors will call ICE on them. Federal policies and court decisions are in flux. Misinformation is rampant on Facebook. On a sunny March day, the line for a food pantry stretches around the block. It's run by La Colaborativa, a nonprofit that serves mostly immigrant communities. People push shopping carts, carry reusable bags, and have scattered conversations, mostly in Spanish, but also in French, Arabic, and English. Jose Ventura, a U.S. citizen who arrived in Chelsea from the Dominican Republic in 1979, says the husband of one of his granddaughters was deported. Quote, her mind has been stuck on that since then, he says in Spanish. It's been hard for me to witness that. Rosa Perlera, also a U.S. citizen, says fear of deportation is leading people to not take their children to school or show up for work, and some have even lost their jobs. The cities suing the government say they're under no legal obligation to help enforce federal immigration law and that their policies boost public safety. Critics say they're obstructing federal law enforcement and protecting criminals. In a social media post about ICE activity in Massachusetts, President Donald Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, said sanctuary cities release safety threats back into the public. Experts say sanctuary policies are misunderstood. Sanctuary has no legal definition and varies depending on the place. No mayor of a city hides illegal aliens under their desk or puts them in City Hall, says Muzaffar Chisti, a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank. Sanctuary jurisdictions, in his view, decide their limited resources are better spent investigating people who commit serious crimes, rather than people who are in the United States illegally but are otherwise law-abiding. But not everyone in Chelsea sees it that way. Todd Taylor was one of two city councilors who voted against reaffirming the policy, which passed 9-2 in 2020. Mr. Taylor says Chelsea is overburdened with unauthorized immigrants living in unsafe conditions. The city's status does little good, he says, and it threatens the loss of badly needed federal funds. That money goes toward infrastructure projects, local law enforcement, school children who need extra support, and services like food pantries and elder care. The lawsuit is, quote, political posturing by the Democratic Party, he says, and Chelsea is a, quote, pawn. Precedent is on the city's side. Judges mostly ruled in favor of sanctuary cities when Mr. Trump tried to slash their federal funding during his first administration, says Oren Selstrom, a lawyer representing Somerville and Chelsea. Appeals courts ruled that withholding federal funding as punishment for sanctuary policies would violate the 10th Amendment, which allows states and localities to regulate their own affairs. One appeals court, however, sided with Mr. Trump in a similar suit in 2020. Quote, it's ridiculous that Chelsea calls itself a sanctuary when ICE can detain people just heading to work in the morning, says Laura. I think it's just a statement to make politicians feel good about themselves right now, she adds. Chelsea's Market Basket is the flagship branch of the popular Northeast grocery chain. Most of the time, quote, you can't walk in an aisle without someone bumping into you, says Gladys Vega, president of La Colaborativa. And the day after federal agents came, it was crickets. It was like the pandemic all over again. End quote. ICE made 370 arrests during an operation March 18th to the 23rd across Massachusetts, including in Chelsea, according to a press release that said 205 had, quote, significant criminal convictions or charges, end quote. Officials seized some illegal drugs and included lists of alleged criminal activity for some who were detained, but did not release their names. Sanctuary policies can actually lead ICE agents to operate more in communities, says Teresa Brown, a former official in U.S. Customs and Border Protection and the Department of Homeland Security under the Bush and Obama administrations. If police don't cooperate, she says, agents make arrests, and people without criminal records could be picked up as well. The Trump administration says its priority is deporting unauthorized immigrants who commit crimes. Recently, it's deported people it says are members of Tren de Aragua, a Venezuela gang. Yet an analysis by Bloomberg found that 90% of them lacked U.S. criminal records. A New York Times investigation had a similar finding. ICE Acting Field Office Director Robert Cerna indicated in a court filing that those who hadn't committed crimes simply hadn't been in the country long enough to do so. This past Friday, a federal judge said the administration has deported people without notice or a chance to tell authorities they face danger if sent to another country, and ruled the administration cannot do that. The next day, the U.S. Supreme Court halted the administration's attempt to deport Venezuelan men it says are gang members, but who haven't had their day in court. And on Sunday, in remarks commemorating the 250th anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord at the start of the American Revolution, Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey referred to, quote, people being disappeared from our streets. Due process is a foundational right. If it can be discarded for one, it can be lost for all, she said. Advocates for sanctuary cities argue that if unauthorized immigrants don't fear being deported, they're more likely to report crimes. That makes the whole community safer, says Somerville City Councilor Matthew McLaughlin. Mr. McLaughlin's family once lived in an apartment building alongside a family of immigrants whose home was burglarized. Quote, if they don't feel comfortable going to the police, they might be repeated victims. And that makes me vulnerable because someone could come along and say, let's rob this other house while we're here, he says. Sanctuary policies decrease deportations by about a third and have no appreciable effect on crime, according to a 2020 study by David Hausman, a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He says increased immigration enforcement is unlikely to lower crime because immigrants already commit fewer offenses than those born in the U.S. Other studies have found that sanctuary policies can lower property crimes and increase the rate at which Hispanic women report domestic violence. Simon Hankinson, a researcher at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, rejects the idea that cooperating with ICE threatens public safety. Quote, we all have to cooperate with laws that we don't personally agree with, he says. If you make a policy decision, as they have, to resist and make it harder for federal law enforcement to do their job, I think there are consequences to go with that, end quote. In Chelsea, lives are being impacted despite the city's sanctuary policies. Laura says she has friends in detention camps, some who were fleeing their home countries. Quote, they don't know how they're going to get back to their country from the detention camp with no family, no support, no money, no housing, she says. And you're just going to get thrown back into a system you're running away from. End quote. This item was entitled, As Cities Fight to Retain Sanctuary Status, Some Immigrants Question the Policy. Now here's the top item in the international column. It's entitled, The European Union Has Wealth and People. Why Isn't It More Competitive? The European Union is the largest single market in the world, yet it is seeing only sluggish economic growth. Why isn't the EU competitive? This item was written by Erica Page, who is a staff writer. Dateline Madrid. As Europe decides how to defend itself against American tariffs, lowering interest rates last week to fight the possibility of recession, a deeper question is driving debate. What does Europe need to do to be competitive in this new world? The continent is one of the richest on the planet. Yet over the past two decades, growth has been sluggish, with most of the gains in the digital and technological spheres centered in the United States. The announcement of President Donald Trump's 20% tariffs on European imports, now on a 90-day hold, gave fresh urgency to the dilemma. As EU policymakers prepare to negotiate or retaliate, they must also equip their own economies to compete in an era of intensifying economic nationalism. If Europe cannot keep up, its security will not be the only core issue on the line, policymakers are saying with increasing urgency. They worry Europe will lose some of its global influence, rooted in the values it champions, from social welfare and climate action at home to democracy and human rights abroad. European markets and the euro saw a boost following Mr. Trump's Liberation Day tariffs as confidence in the American market tanked. But many European economies rely heavily on exports, and a trade war would be bad news for those producers. Underlying these issues is a concern that has been brewing since the turn of the century. The home of the Industrial Revolution is no longer seen as a place where innovation thrives, especially in the technological sector. Only 4 of the top 50 tech companies are European. Startups that make it big often relocate to Silicon Valley or go public on the New York Stock Exchange instead of at home. While not everything comes down to tech, this points to a deeper concern, says Rebecca Christie, a senior fellow at Bruegel, an economic think tank in Brussels. Quote, Europe does not have a risk culture, and it's a big problem, she says. The biggest thing holding Europe back is growth, end quote. Since the mid-1990s, productivity has grown nearly twice as fast in the U.S. as in Europe. The difference is minimal when tech is excluded. The U.S. enjoys a gross domestic product that is double the per capita average in Europe, which has lagged in key sectors, including artificial intelligence, semiconductors, and cloud computing. It is not clear how Europe's workforce will continue to support those in retirement without a significant increase in immigration. By 2070, there are expected to be more Europeans over the age of 65 than those of working age. Economist Mario Draghi called the economic situation nothing less than an existential challenge in his seminal report on European competitiveness last fall. If the trend continues, Europe will become, quote, less prosperous, less equal, less secure, and as a result, less free to choose our destiny, Dr. Draghi told the European Parliament. The European Commission underscored Dr. Draghi's argument in a competitiveness compass document it released earlier this year. Quote, in this world, Europe's competitiveness and what Europe stands for are inseparable, the document said. Our freedom, security, and autonomy will depend more than ever on our ability to innovate, compete, and grow, end quote. Part of the problem is Europe's difficulty in scaling startups into the sort of global giants coming out of the U.S. European scale-ups, highly productive, fast-growing companies, raise 50% less capital than their Silicon Valley peers in their first 10 years. The top 10 American companies invest 3 times as much in research and development, key to continued growth, as their European counterparts. Companies that do take off often move elsewhere. Close to a third of the private startups founded in Europe and that reached a valuation of $1 billion relocated abroad between 2008 and 2021, the majority across the Atlantic. The EU raises 5% of the world's venture capital funds, compared with 52% in the U.S. and 40% in China. The United Kingdom raises 3%. And while American startups have immediate access to a market of 340 million consumers, European firms must navigate dozens of distinct legal systems. A punchline highlights Europe's predicament. Quote, "The U.S. innovates, China replicates, and Europe regulates," end quote. Over half of small and medium businesses name regulations and administrative burden as their top challenges. It is the second biggest concern for startups. Beyond the tech sector, European industries have struggled for other reasons. Last year, industrial electricity prices were 2.5 times higher than in the U.S., and gas prices over 4 times higher. The European Commission's competitiveness compass laid out the goal of making it easier for businesses to grow. The strategy includes plans to harmonize regulations across borders and raise spending on research and development to 3% of Europe's economic output. Another proposal is to create a savings and investment union that would encourage Europeans to invest in one centralized capital market rather than holding savings in banks, as is common in Europe. And the Commission is raising 20 billion euros, or $22 billion, to build massive AI gigafactories for artificial intelligence computing and development. In Germany, whose sluggish growth has caused particular concern in recent years, some sectors are seeing progress. Known as Silicon Saxony, the region around Dresden has established itself as Europe's leading microelectronics hub, producing a third of the continent's chips, which power nearly all modern technologies, from smartphones to electric vehicles. French President Emmanuel Macron announced 109 billion euros, or $124 billion, in private investment in the country's burgeoning AI ecosystem. France is home to Europe's largest and most valuable AI startup, Mistral AI. Amid concerns about the climate crisis and an economy that encourages overconsumption, some have argued that Europe must learn to live with a smaller pie, including calls for a degrowth model that would prioritize social and ecological needs. But Ms. Christie from Bruegel disagrees. Quote, "The idea that somehow we should just content ourselves with less and become smaller, that's not going to help," she says. "Europe needs to be ambitious," she adds. "If Europe can grow, then it can support itself and its people and quality of life," end quote. This item was entitled "The European Union Has Wealth and People. Why Isn't It More Competitive?" And now here is today's editorial by the Monitor's editorial board. It's entitled, "In Post-War Ethiopia, A Stand on Higher Ground." A potential for renewed war in Tigray state was averted after two former foes, the prime minister and a Tigrayan general, helped rebalance a peace deal that ended the deadly 2020 to 2022 war. Here is the editorial. Nations prone to split over ethnic or religious divides often find ways to bond by embracing a higher civic identity. Ethiopia just set a small example of that. Two top leaders from different ethnic groups found a way to avert a renewal of a vicious war that ended 2 years ago. Peace prevails for now in Ethiopia's restive state of Tigray, as does a desire for unity around national ideals. Less than a month ago, most observers of East African politics widely expected that simmering tensions in Tigray would boil over into conflict again. Their concerns were heightened when disgruntled members of Tigray's security forces seized key government buildings in an intra-Tigrayan dispute over jobs. Three officers had been suspended by the state's interim administration. The then head of Tigray called for direct federal intervention after he fled in March to the nation's capital. But rather than act on that request, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed wisely appointed Lieutenant General Tadis Wired, a Tigrayan and a former battlefield foe in the war, to lead the interim administration. The state's temporary government was set up as part of a negotiated peace deal in 2022. The appointment, quote, is not merely a change in leadership, wrote a commentator in the Addis Standard, but shifts the calculus from confrontation to reconstruction, end quote. In accepting the appointment, Mr. Tadis, whose military reputation provides him legitimacy in his new role, affirmed full implementation of the peace deal. He stressed, quote, we must work together by moving away from the idea of winners and losers, end quote. The Prime Minister also took the high road in a posting on the platform X. Quote, it is my hope that Mr. Tadisi will seize this historic opportunity to help the people of Tigray realize their aspirations for peace and development, just like their fellow citizens across the country, end quote. Much still needs to be done to avoid other ethnic flare-ups. Amhara State, for example, still holds a part of Tigray. That standoff hampers the return of more than 1 million displaced Tigrayans to their homes. In Africa's second most populous country, different groups are still battling over rights, resources, and borders. Yet a different message from two top leaders is showing a more collaborative and less combative approach. This was today's editorial by the Monitor's editorial board, entitled In Postwar Ethiopia, A Stand on Higher Ground. And now a moment for station identification. This is just a reminder, you are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, the new sound of information access, with 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Now back to U.S. items. This one is entitled, What U.S. Aid Cuts Mean for Peru as It Battles Cartels on Coca Gold Trade. Peru received $135 million in U.S. aid funding in 2024. Substantial contributions were for areas ranging from democratic governance to minority rights. This item was written by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer for the Monitor. Dateline Lima, Peru. In Peru's Amazon region, drug gangs running the coca trade in cooperation with Mexican cartels have, over recent years, expanded into illegal mining, especially for gold. In response, the U.S. Agency for International Development shifted some counter-narcotics and development resources in Peru to buttress non-governmental organizations combating illegal mining through environmental and sustainable development initiatives. But now, with the Trump administration eliminating U.S. aid and folding reduced humanitarian and development assistance budgets into the State Department, some Peruvians worry that progress against illegal mining will be reversed. Moreover, the intertwined nature of the illegal trades that Peru confronts, from coca and gold to wildlife and even people, means that less attention to illegal mining is likely to mean smoother sailing for other trafficking operations as well. Quote, "The new menace we face in Peru is the cocaine-gold connection, but the exit of USAID funding is going to set back the initial strides we have made to counter this threat," says Ricardo Soberón, a former executive director of DEVIDA, Peru's National Commission for Development and Life Without Drugs. Quote, "Overall, for Peru, it's a bad thing to lose USAID funding for a variety of reasons," he says. "But specifically for this new mining menace, it's terrible timing," end quote. The elimination of USAID is part of a significant overhaul and downsizing of the State Department and its diplomatic functions that Secretary of State Marco Rubio is engineering. On Tuesday, Mr. Rubio unveiled elements of a sweeping State Department reorganization that eliminates more than a dozen agencies and absorbs formerly separate functions into others. He says the long-overdue reorganization will deliver a more efficient and focused diplomacy for the, quote, "greater power competition of the 21st century." Critics, including Democratic members of Congress, counter that the Trump administration's plans target longtime U.S. interests in democratization, human rights, and international justice, and will damage America's standing on the world stage. Mr. Soberón highlights the cocaine-gold nexus because he says the U.S. response was emblematic of how USAID often operated in Peru. U.S. funding was akin to seed money to get an initiative off the ground, he says. In this case, USAID money underwrote creation of an environmental crimes pilot project that supported a separate environmental justice system with police, prosecutors, and judges, as well as environmental NGOs working on sustainable development and mining substitution. The idea was that the Peruvian government would eventually take over the project, says Mr. Soberón, a counter-narcotics analyst and alternative development expert. Quote, "But there was a need for a second stage to that U.S. support," he adds, noting that illegal mining has expanded to 20 of Peru's 24 regions. Quote, "Now it's unclear what will happen to the whole effort," end quote. Last year alone, Peru received $135 million in USAID funding. And while the broad array of projects under the counter-narcotics umbrella received much of that money, Substantial contributions were also made in areas ranging from democratic governance and minority rights to independent press development. The elimination of most of the U.S. humanitarian and development funding can't help but set back those efforts, many here say. But some experts and former officials insist that in the long run, the United States will also come out the loser by exiting what some here refer to as the people-to-people side of democracy. Quote, "The current U.S. administration talks about all of these programs in terms of cost and burden," says Cynthia Sanborn, a professor of political science at Universidad del Pacífico in Lima. Quote, "There seems to be no recognition that the goodwill and favorability these efforts built up over the long haul benefited the U.S. tremendously," end quote. Last month, the State Department notified Congress it was dissolving USAID and absorbing some functions. Secretary Rubio had already announced that about 80% of USAID's programs had been eliminated. Last week, speculation grew that a significant State Department downsizing was imminent. A reorganization chart leaked this week suggests a nearly 20% reduction in agencies and staffing. According to Secretary Rubio, new streamlined humanitarian and development efforts will reflect, quote, "America's values and will cut waste." Some experts in Peru acknowledge that decades of USAID funding have not always yielded positive results. Quote, "After 30 years of U.S. counter-narcotics efforts through USAID and other agencies, we still have the same amount of coca production," says Mr. Soberon, noting that Peru is the second largest supplier of cocaine to the U.S. after Colombia. Quote, "Yes, we have had some successes in alternative development, replacing coca in some areas with cacao and coffee," he says, "but something is not working," end quote. Mr. Soberon says he's often encountered what he considered to be inefficient and overly bureaucratic operations at USAID. Neighboring Bolivia achieved better results in coca substitution with the holistic community development model it instituted after ordering USAID out of the country in 2013, he says. But he says Peru has benefited from years of U.S. partnership in areas like institution building and grassroots organization support. Others say that from what they observed, USAID recently was actually becoming more effective in Peru, both in terms of the kinds of programs and initiatives it was encouraging and as an effective promoter of values traditionally associated with the U.S., such as democracy, transparency, and human rights. Quote, "My impression was that USAID was an agency that was improving, working better, and making strides into the soft diplomacy that, if done right, can accomplish a lot," says Gustavo Goriti, founder of the IDL Reporteros investigative journalism site. Quote, "Experience demonstrates that this kind of soft diplomacy is effective over the long term in the countries where it's applied, but also for the United States and its projection of power," he says. "However, from what we're seeing," he adds, "these are things that are of no importance whatsoever to the current administration." This item was entitled, "What USAID Cuts Mean for Peru as It Battles Cartels on Coca Gold Trade." This next U.S. item is entitled, 4 years on, Trump is still focused on his 2020 loss. Even as ongoing defamation lawsuits find no evidence of a fraudulent election, President Donald Trump keeps insisting that the 2020 vote was rigged. He is issuing orders targeting officials and lawyers whose work undercut his claims and demanding states tighten voting rules to prevent alleged fraud. This item was written by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer for the Monitor. Most politicians never forget the races they lost, but perhaps no elected official has ever been as fixated on an electoral defeat as President Donald Trump. Despite successfully recapturing the White House last November, Mr. Trump has continued to circle back with regularity to the 2020 election, which he still insists was stolen from him. In remarks as well as presidential actions, he appears intent on reshaping the official narrative surrounding his 4-year-old loss, even as new evidence continues to reinforce the reality of that defeat. Mr. Trump frequently frames the presidency of Joe Biden as illegitimate. The war in Ukraine, quote, would never have happened if the 2020 election had not been rigged. In other words, if I were president, he wrote on Truth Social on April 13th. He has made similar claims about the October 7th, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel. As president, Mr. Trump has pushed out members of the Justice Department who investigated his efforts to overturn Mr. Biden's victory, which culminated in the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. His administration reportedly vetted appointees specifically on their views of who won the 2020 election. One of his first official acts as president was to pardon hundreds of people convicted of federal crimes related to the January 6th rioting, which resulted in the loss of lives among both protesters and police, and injuries to more than 140 law enforcement officers. Parallel to his actions looking back to 2020, Mr. Trump has also sought to dictate how states run elections, asserting power to enforce federal laws in a sweeping executive order that includes provisions on mail-in ballots, proof of citizenship, and the certification of voting machines. Conspiracy theories about machines flipping votes to Mr. Biden featured prominently in Mr. Trump's rear guard efforts in 2020 to stay in power. Multiple states are challenging the executive order in court. While it is not clear whether it all stems from a deep insecurity, an effort to elevate his legacy, or a larger political strategy to wield greater power over future elections, Mr. Trump's preoccupation with 2020 appears to be driving significant presidential actions and policies in ways that could have real implications for U.S. democracy. Quote, "It's a grievances politics that's at the center of his worldview," says Nicole Hemmer, a historian at Vanderbilt University who directs the Rogers Center for the American Presidency. Quote, "It's about throwing into question the outcome of elections and damaging people's trust in that outcome," end quote. Vetting appointees on their views of the 2020 election is a particularly chilling assertion of presidential power, says Professor Hemmer. Quote, "It's not a test of whether you believe the election was stolen. It's whether you're willing to say the election was stolen," end quote. In polls, a majority of Republican voters continue to say they believe the 2020 election was fraudulent, echoing Mr. Trump's claims. Yet multiple judicial challenges, state audits, and defamation lawsuits related to fraud claims have come and gone without providing any basis for doubt about the outcome. Mr. Trump's rhetoric has already had a corrosive effect on democracy, says David Becker, who heads the Center for Election Innovation and Research, a nonprofit that works with election officials. In the wake of misinformation spread about 2020, unprecedented levels of abuse and threats have occurred against the state and local officials who oversee elections. Quote, public servants, Democrats and Republicans, have been hounded because of these lies, he says. He adds, quote, it's unfortunate we have a losing candidate that won't accept his loss, end quote. One arena where Mr. Trump's claims of a stolen election have been repeatedly punctured is in defamation cases. A series of lawsuits brought by Dominion Voting Systems against right-wing media outlets have highlighted the falsehoods told by Mr. Trump's allies on air about the company, which manufactures electronic voting machines, scanning devices, and software. Some Trump allies have faced their own defamation suits. Rudy Giuliani, Mr. Trump's former lawyer, was found liable for defaming two Georgia election workers in connection with the 2020 election and ordered to pay a $148 million judgment. Carrie Lake, who unsuccessfully ran for governor of Arizona in 2022, settled for an undisclosed amount last year with Stephen Richter, a GOP county recorder whom she had falsely accused of rigging her defeat. In both cases, neither defendant contested the evidence presented in court, instead moving to the damages phase. Their acceptance of liability is telling, says Mr. Becker, a former civil rights attorney at the Department of Justice. Quote, the truth is an absolute defense in defamation, he says. The latest defamation ruling came on April 9th, when a judge in Delaware found that Newsmax had broadcast multiple false claims about Dominion. A jury is due to decide on potential damages later this month. In 2023, Fox News paid $787 million to settle with Dominion after a similar finding. Analysts say Newsmax, whose owner Chris Ruddy is a confidant of Mr. Trump, may also settle out of court with Dominion to avoid a jury trial. On the same day as the Newsmax verdict, Mr. Trump ordered an investigation of Chris Krebs, his former director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. He had fired Mr. Krebs in November 2020 after the director said there was no evidence of computer fraud in the presidential election. His agency had called the election, quote, the most secure in American history, infuriating the embattled president. Mr. Trump also signed an executive order to end federal contracting with a Houston-based law firm that represented Dominion in its defamation lawsuits against media organizations. Sussman Godfrey, the latest law firm to be targeted, has since won an injunction from a federal judge temporarily blocking the order, with the judge called, quote, a shocking abuse of power. Mr. Trump promised retribution, and that's what's going on, says Jane Kirtley, a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota. Quote, "He's very thin-skinned and he has a very long memory," end quote. The executive action against Mr. Krebs is notable for naming an individual rather than an institution, such as a law firm or university. It revokes security clearances held by Mr. Krebs, who is now a cybersecurity consultant. And it calls him a significant bad faith actor who weaponized and abused his government authority, claiming that he censored conservative viewpoints. While signing the document, Mr. Trump claimed falsely that more and more fraud had been discovered about the 2020 election. Quote, "So we'll find out whether or not it was a safe election, and if it wasn't, he's got a big price to pay, and he's a bad guy," he said, referring to Mr. Krebs. "This illegitimate use of presidential power is deeply troubling," says Professor Hemmer. Quote, "The 2020 loyalty test is one you have to pass to be part of the administration. Now we're seeing the flip side," she says. "You'll be singled out and punished for dissent." Mr. Trump's March 25th executive order on protecting the integrity of elections doesn't refer explicitly to 2020, but it justifies its actions as necessary to prevent fraud. It would require those who register to vote to prove their citizenship, impose stricter deadlines for mail-in ballots, and empower federal agencies to review state voter lists. Several lawsuits have been filed against it by states and left-leaning groups. Some conservatives have also criticized it as federal overreach that flouts states' constitutional rights to run elections. Quote, "Elections may have national consequences, but the power to conduct them rests in state capitals. No public mandate, real or perceived, lets Washington tamper with its authority, not even for a worthy cause like election integrity," wrote former Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal earlier this month. Congress has also taken up the issue of citizenship and voter registrations. The House recently passed the SAVE Act, which imposes new mandates that Republicans argue are needed to prevent non-citizens from voting. It's already illegal for non-citizens to vote in federal elections, and instances appear to be very rare. Many Democrats say proof of citizenship requirements would disenfranchise legitimate voters who don't have ready access to documents such as birth certificates. Mr. Trump has repeatedly claimed, without evidence, that Democrats are getting votes from immigrants who are in the country illegally. After he won the Electoral College but lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton in 2016, he set up a commission to investigate such alleged illegal voting. The commission disbanded after failing to turn up proof to support Mr. Trump's claims. In the 2024 campaign, Mr. Trump and his allies made further claims without evidence, including that Democrats had imported millions of migrants into swing states to vote for his opponent, Kamala Harris. Polling shows that a majority of Americans support anti-fraud measures such as voter ID and citizenship checks, says Matt Germer, who heads the Governance Policy Program at the R Street Institute, a think tank in Washington that favors limited government and free markets. But he's concerned that fear-mongering by Mr. Trump is undermining public faith in the ballot box. Quote, "Our elections are trustworthy," he says. Ironically, the push from Republicans for stricter rules on voter registration may cut against their own partisan interests. While Democrats may once have benefited from making it easier to cast a ballot, that's now at odds with the coalition assembled by Mr. Trump, which includes many irregular voters who only turn out when he's on the ballot. Quote, Republicans are now becoming the party of late deciding low propensity voters who may not be showing up to the polling stations with all their documentation, says Mr. Germer. And this item was entitled, 4 years on, Trump is still focused on his 2020 loss. And finally, this item entitled, They Wanted to Build Affordable Housing. The Town Took Their Land. A federal case out of Rhode Island could set a precedent in government's power over private developments. Can eminent domain be used to halt development in the name of public good? This item was written by Jingnan Peng and Mackenzie Farkas, both staff writers for the Monitor. Ralph Santoro and Salvatore Campagnon found out their land had been seized through social media. The 31-acre plot where they had planned to build an affordable housing complex lies on the edge of Johnston, a suburb of Providence. The seizure was announced on March 14th. Johnston Mayor Joseph Palesini Jr., a vocal opponent of the housing project, wrote on Facebook and X that the town had taken the land by eminent domain. The plan was to build a new government complex there. Mr. Santoro and Mr. Campagnon received orders to vacate the plot in 1 week or be cited for trespassing. They and their relatives immediately took the matter to court. It felt like I was being physically assaulted, says Mr. Santoro, whose family purchased the land in the 1980s. Our properties are a passion for us. For his part, the mayor says that he's acting to provide the police and fire departments with needed facilities. And that concludes today's program. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor News Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good night and good news.